This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just about every week, we hear reports of gang violence. But many of today's gangs aren't fighting with just fists and knives. They have guns. And many gangs are big money-making operations, selling illegal weapons and drugs. My guest, Martin Sanchez-Jankowski, recently completed a 10-year study of street gangs. His findings are reported in his new book, Islands in the Street, Gangs and American Urban Society. Jankowski is a sociologist and runs a project on Chicano and Latino policy at the University of California at Berkeley. In the 1970s, he was studying the political attitudes of Latino youth. He noticed an enormously high percentage of Chicanos and Puerto Ricans belonged to gangs. In order to understand these low-income communities, he felt it was necessary to understand why the gang phenomenon had persisted in the U.S. for more than 100 years. So for the next decade, he lived among 37 gangs in three cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Boston. The gang members came from many different ethnic groups, Irish, African American, Puerto Rican, Chicano, Dominican, Jamaican, and Central American. And the members ranged in age from 11 to 42. But before agreeing to let him study them, each of the gangs tested him.
Well, they did two things. They had two real tests for me. The first test was the obvious ones, to see if I was a police plant, to see if I was going to tell the police what their operations were all about, and when somebody did something illegal with it, to help the police bust them. So the first thing they would do is, for about a month, they would do a number of illegal things that weren't minor, but illegal things, to see if the police came down on them. And they would also follow me if I didn't stay with them. And if I went back to, say, a friend's apartment or something, they would follow me and see if I made any contact with the police. That was the first thing. And the second thing they did was to try to see how tough I was, whether I could hold my own in a fight. And so they would ask somebody to, usually one person would start a fight, though sometimes it was more than one person. And it was okay to fight and lose, but it wasn't okay not to fight, because fighting is... or the ability to fight is quite functional. So they wanted to know that their backs would be protected if I was with them.
So how did you do?
I did well. I had training, and I have a second-degree black belt in karate, so I...
Oh, okay. I guess they were impressed.
Yeah, they were impressed. Yeah, that's right. Although, you know, when they add the numbers in other words, when they add two or three, you know, so I'd take some bruises. I wouldn't necessarily lose. But sometimes I wouldn't win, especially when they'd have a lot of people involved. It would basically be a standoff.
One thing you want your book to do is to challenge the preconceptions that many of us have about why people join gangs. How do you think your findings challenge the preconceptions?
Well, I think they challenge it on a number of grounds. First, my findings don't show people to be pathological. That is, people who are sadistic, people who have a psychological problem that makes them predisposed to doing physical aggression and causing all kinds of violence on people. That's one. Second, it challenges the notion that the people who are in gangs are have low IQs, the lowest of the low, lower class. And are incompetent to do anything other than cause problems for society, because these are very competent people, quite business-oriented, in fact. Third, that gangs terrorize individuals or young individuals in their neighborhood to join them all the time. That's their primary recruiting sort of ploy. That doesn't happen. That there is a mixture between doing sophisticated recruiting and limiting the number in a gang, because gangs are more business-oriented.
You studied gangs for about a decade. Did you see crack change any of the gangs, how they made money, how they behaved?
Yes. Crack had to be seen really as a commodity within the drug economy. It is what I like to say is the McDonald's of drugs. And what I mean by that is that crack, as a derivative of cocaine, is really affordable to a number of people in the low-income community which could not afford cocaine. So what that did to the drug economy was allow a number of organizations and individuals to break into the economy that were excluded before and to make large profits from it. And one of those organizations has been the gang. And what that has meant, basically, is that individuals, gangs have been able to recruit more individuals because they've needed them in terms of their business to spread out and to, in fact, expand in different areas. And individuals, that is young people in the community, have also seen this as an opportunity, and an opportunity that has just emerged as a result of a new product, with a lot of potential for them to have mobility within this area of the economy.
Some of the gangs that you observed had profit-making rackets, stolen car parts, illegal guns, in addition to selling drugs, gambling operations. Did you ever go with the gangs on crime sprees to watch how they did it?
I went with gangs when they were involved in economic activities that individuals that society has called illegal, yes.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, there's times in which you would go to places where they would be trading off large quantities of stolen products with a wholesaler. I was there. I would be sometimes late, perhaps on a scene, but still there when people who were in charge of stealing radios were bringing their booty, so to speak, back to sort of headquarters or the main warehouse to be stored. I was there when they would set up operations, for example, for cockfights or dominoes games or illegal liquor places, and be in the premises when those activities were, in fact, being engaged in. So there's a range of things that I did see.
When you were with people from a gang as they were committing a crime or holding somebody up or anything like that, how did you deal with it as an observer? I'm sure your instincts would be to try to protect the person who was getting robbed or hurt, but you're, as a sociologist or anthropologist, I mean, that's not what you're there for.
Well, that's a good question. It's before you start any kind of work in the field like this, you have to decide what you are willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And I was very clear right from the start in my own mind what I was willing to do and what I wasn't. And what I was not willing to do and what I told them I would not do was to either rob somebody myself, peddle drugs, take drugs, and be involved in any planning of any illegal activity. In observing illegal activity, there are plenty of times I can tell you that I was uncomfortable, but the fact of the matter is, this was my job. If I was to make a contribution, not just to academics, but to people in general, so that we could understand the situation better and perhaps even make some kind of policy recommendations that might help the situation, I would need to be as objective and as neutral as I could, and that's what I did when I was in the field.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Sanchez-Jankowski. He's a sociologist who chairs the Chicano Latino Policy Project at the University of California at Berkeley. And he studied gangs for about 10 years, and he's written a new book on it called Islands in the Street, Gangs and American Urban Society. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sociologist Martin Sanchez-Jankowski is my guest, author of a new book about gangs called Islands in the Street. What kinds of attitudes toward women did you find? I mean, I think, the whole gangster image, at least as it's expressed in rap music, is a very sexist one.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And I would say if gangs as organizations are certainly not progressive as they relate to women. I mean, women are just treated as property. There's no other way, nice way to say that. It's essentially the way women are looked upon, as the property of individuals, not as the group, not as group property, but as property of the individuals in them.
Was rape considered acceptable?
Rape is not considered acceptable. If you're talking about, the kind of rape that would be acceptable is the kind that we see in society where we would say a husband rape. I guess I don't know if that's the right term for it. But then that would be considered acceptable. I mean, the fact that somebody's woman resisted his sexual advances, I mean, he could muscle her down and, of course, have sex with her. I mean, that would be some form of rape. Now, that's acceptable, but raping somebody else in the community really is not acceptable because it brings enormous amounts of, you know, retribution from members of the community and also perhaps from other family members, and it really basically holds down the organization's ability to become active economically.
Some of the gangs that you observed sold illegal guns to make a profit. Where did they get the guns from?
Well, there's a large black market in guns that runs all the way from Canada overseas. I mean, from Europe, Canada, and Mexico. What they usually do is to buy these guns illegally, and then they also ship them to both foreign countries. As the case of the Irish gangs that I studied, you know, they were very, very involved in getting weapons to Northern Ireland. And in the case of other groups, they were very important in setting up gun shops that were illegal, of course, and in selling guns to various people in the drug industry, as well as everyday people. You know, one thing I can report, which most people failed to realize, is that a lot of these illegal products get in the hands of middle-class people who themselves would say they hate gangs. For example, a lot of the guns that are in the illegal market that we're now talking about end up in middle-class homes, people who are afraid of other predators, robbers of some sort or another. And so they'll buy a gun on the illegal market that's less expensive and less traceable. So one of the things that was surprising to me is to find out that there is a very large clientele that are everyday people in middle-class society that are prepared to buy these kinds of weapons.
Did you find that the gangs that sold illegal weapons used weapons more often?
No, not use the weapons more often than, say, other gangs that were not in this business. I think all gangs seem prone to use weapons much more often than they did, say, 20 years ago, partly because of availability. And once they're available, then you use something, and the more you use it, the more willing you are to use it. So I think that's the dynamic that now occurs. It's just that, you know, the weapons are so sophisticated out there now and so lethal that we're seeing much more destruction as a result of that.
Did you witness any shootouts? And if so, I'd like you to describe, like, how it happened and what happened.
Well, yes. Sometimes they're random. I mean, I was a recipient of one of those. In fact, I got hurt as a result of somebody an ambush. So the ambushes often occur.
You got shot?
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you get shot?
In the leg.
And what happened? What was the shootout
about?
Well,
it was an ambush of one gang against the other for both of these gangs at the time were in a struggle for a particular kind of geographic area, what's known as a turf war. But it was a turf war over economics. One of the gangs wanted to move into a particular area to sell drugs and was being resisted by another gang. And so they had just been, the one particular gang I was hanging out with had just been successful in moving into this area with a lot of force. And one night I was walking with them, and there was a series of shots. There was an ambush and a retaliation for this. One just hit me. So that's one of the areas that can happen that is an ambush situation. The other situation, of course, is that you're on the other side and you're aggressively going forward in terms of attacking another gang and to try to send a message to them. So that's also the way a way in which violence can occur and shootings can occur. And then there's the third way, in which there's either a meeting or a planned meeting or almost like a war with a front in which both groups come not surprised by the other and there's a shooting involved or there's a big fight involved I was involved in one of those big fights as well and got hurt in that one as well. So there's a lot of chances to get hurt in terms of being associated with gangs, not just simply for the researcher, but more importantly for the people who are involved.
What happened to you that second time?
I got knifed in the wrist severely and required 50 stitches inside and out, so it wasn't a minor sort of scrape.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Sanchez-Jankowski, and he's written a new book based on his 10-year study of gangs. It's called Islands in the Street, Gangs and American Urban Society. Were any of your gangs involved with organized crime? Because after all, if you're selling illegal guns and if you're buying and selling drugs, it's really easy to think you'd end up involved with organized crime.
Yes, they're involved in organized crime in a number of ways. The first is that directly, people should understand that in the use of the word organized crime has become sort of one of those vague terms. And so there are different elements of organized crime, and they're involved in all these elements. Now, in the top element, I suppose, if we wanted to look at it as the type of organized crime that we've associated with the Italian ethnic group, and we've called the mafia. And the mafia has basically been involved, particularly in New York, in wholesaling drugs. So they wholesale to local organized crime people who then utilize the gang in a number of ways, either as a retailer themselves. So they're linked that way down the chain of that area of the economy. And secondly, they also are linked many times because they're hired to protect people who are retailers on the street. They may not be retailing themselves, but they'll protect the people who are retailing on the street. Or they're hired to become the primary people responsible for collection of money that from people who have been delinquent in paying off their bills for the drugs. So you can see that they're that area, that they're just in the drug economy that they can be involved in now. And there are other areas that they're involved in as well. They can be hired out as arsonists and often are by people in an organized crime. They are also hired out by people who are involved in various aspects of gambling, for example, numbers games or dominoes and card games or cockfights to be involved in protecting those establishments against other competitors or even protecting themselves from the police. So there's that area that they're involved in too. So you can see they can be involved in a lot of ways without being sort of the training grounds or the, or sort of the little leagues, the minor leagues to organized crime by just feeding them individuals.
Did you end up feeling for the people who you were with or feeling afraid of them?
No, I'm from those areas. So let me just say, some people have tried to, think that this is an apologist, sort of view of gangs, and this is just not it. It's not pro or con. And I can just tell you right now, there are people there who I, feel very close to and I like as friends, and there are people who I find disgusting. I don't want to see the rest, I don't care if I see them the rest of my life. So, I think it's a mixed bag, just like everything in life. I never went into this thing finding out about something I didn't know about in terms of seeing gang members before or after. I grew up with gang members, in those areas. So I wasn't learning about them for the first time and seeing that there was a humanity involved. I was more, I knew there was a humanity involved in sort of most individuals. So what I did is I just learned about them as a sociological phenomenon and tried to pass that on.
I'm wondering what happened to some of the people who got too old for the gangs and moved on to other things. Have you followed what happened to them?
Mm-hmm. Some of I have, and one of my projects is basically to see what happens to gang members. But I can just tell you that some go on to various areas of organized crime. Some goes on to areas of just plain crime. Some, go on to prisons for long periods in their life, and some die not only as a result of gang violence, but die as a part of low-income life, various things, high blood pressure, heart attacks, those kinds of things. And a lot of them take on the jobs that they were trying to avoid all their lives, those secondary labor market jobs that their parents had, that they hope they could really escape, and they take them on and become, you know, depressed people. What I had called sort of in the book was social death. You know, people walk through life and make do, but very unhappy people, many of whom become alcoholic and abusive.
Obviously, American society isn't doing all that well in dealing with gangs. You're the head of a policy institute at UC Berkeley. Does your study leave you with any conclusions about what we're doing wrong and we should be doing differently in terms of our social policies?
Yeah, I believe it is. I would say there is a number of areas that we should improve on. First of all, we've poured enormous amounts of money into deterrence, and deterrence is just not working. We've had gangs for 150 years, and deterrence, no matter how much money we pour in, it just does not work. I mean, we haven't eradicated gangs at all. In fact, they've grown. So that ought to lead us to another direction, and that direction, I think, is to encourage private enterprise to basically invest in low-income areas and to invest in those areas by setting up their businesses in their areas, in those areas, and hiring people from those areas. We've got to have people, government agencies, training individuals in terms of technology, in terms of the kinds of technological expertise that they could use to get a job. We can't be training them for jobs that don't exist anymore, and that's one of the things that we've done. Or once we've trained them, one of the problems I've often encountered is gang members will get into job training programs and they'll get out of job training programs completely trained and competent and not find a job. That is, there's no placement for them. There's no placement agency. So I think there's that area that we could do. And I think also we could improve on recreation for a number, organized recreation, but not to emphasize recreation over these other aspects that I've just indicated, because too many times we think just giving them a baseball or a basketball will take them out of gangs, and that just won't happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And my guest has been sociologist Martin Sanchez Jankowski. He studied gangs for about a decade, and his new book is called Islands in the Street, Gangs in American Urban Society. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.